Well, it seems like we haven't lost too many. I don't know. Introductions are difficult because when you start from nowhere. And so it's never always clear where one should start. So hopefully it wasn't too overwhelming or confusing. I think you'll see in this lecture, these lectures today and lectures coming, why I said the things I said on the first occasion. Hopefully it'll begin to make sense as it's played out in practice. I wanted to address one issue that came up having to do with apologetics and might help explain once again why I'm covering the sorts of material I'm covering and why I'm doing it this way. If you look at John chapter 4, well, you don't have to look there. I'll just read the bits where Jesus meets this woman at the well. And he says to her, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." And then a little farther down, the disciples return. And they said, "Why are you talking with her?" So the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, "Come, see a man who told me all that I ever did. Could this be the Christ?" They went out of the town and were coming to him. And then if you go back to chapter 2, verse 23, it says, "Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus on his part did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man." Now, when we do apologetics, there's an apologetics course that I guess you could take here this summer or at some point. You're usually looking for some ways of answering certain kinds of questions, methods. But, I won't be teaching that course, but maybe what you'll hear is the most important thing about apologetics is not the apologetics, but the apologist. That's you, the person who has the relationship with the person that you're talking to. And that's the most one of the most fundamental things in being able to communicate the gospel is that relationship. And that relationship is based on, well, it's based on many things, but one of the chief things that it's based on is your knowledge of that person. And what I'm trying to do in this course is to help you to understand what sort of people that we are and who we talk to these days in the modern world. And so that's why I'm covering the material I'm covering in historical and philosophical fashion. So that like Christ, when he met the woman in the well, he knew her. Now, of course, we are not prophets, and we don't know people in the comprehensive way that he does, but there's a lot that we can do to know people and therefore be much more effective in how we communicate with them. So I just wanted to begin with that as an introduction. So today we'll have two lectures. I'm going to talk a little bit longer. I felt like last time maybe I left a little too many things open-ended. So I'm going to try to seal things up a little tighter when I speak so that it won't be as confusing. Today the theme is, did I give a title for the day? Just a moment. Just look for my outline of the course. Yes. Today, nothing but matter and motion, mechanism and freedom. So the first talk I'll give is the mechanical revolution, particularly natural philosophy in the 17th century. You may hear me use the word natural philosophy a lot. It was sort of the proper term for what we might attribute to science nowadays, philosophy of nature. So, off we go. Now, I promised it was going to be a little less confusing. I guess this first quotation in Latin doesn't get us off to a very good start. But it's translated there for you. So this is the definition of motion, a very ordinary concept, something we're accustomed to every day, as it was understood in the Middle Ages by the scholastics, also known as the schoolmen, or the guys who taught in the schools, university folks, who were also churchmen at the same time. And the philosophy of Aristotle, as I explained last time, was predominant in the university in the Middle Ages and shaped the way that most things in philosophic or theological discussion were articulated. It shaped the form of intellectual discussion. And that included not only matters of theology, but also things in nature, science, any sort of advanced reflection on natural phenomena. And motion is, of course, a very basic concept. So it has this, there is this definition, motus est actus entis in potentia, quatenus in potentia. That is, motion is the act, I'll leave that in quotes for the moment, of what is in potential insofar as in potential. That's very obscure and it doesn't make any sense as it stands. Right. The reason I put the Latin up there is because what we're dealing with is a totally different way of thinking about things. A vocabulary that's totally foreign to how we talk now. I mean, there are words like act and potential, but that's not how we use those words. It's a very different definition of motion. So I'm going to try to explain it to you, and the reason I want to explain it to you is I want you to see where things were and then what happened around the time of the 17th century that brought about our understanding of motion, which is very far removed from what we have here. So in order to do that, we'll have a ball. Ordinary is, standard billiard balls we talk about for motion. Here's a ball. It's in potential, okay? It's in a state that's before some subsequent state. So it's a ball that's in potential. It's ready to go, you could say. And then it's going to move, and while it's moving, it's acting. However, it's still in potential while it's moving, okay? It hasn't achieved its final state. And then when it gets there, it is no longer in potential, okay? I'll just go back again. So you start with the ball in potential, and then while it's moving, it's still in potential, but it's acting. So that's why we have the act of what is still in potential. So motion is something that's still in the state of being going towards something, okay? It seems foreign and convoluted, but it was deeply founded within philosophy of Aristotle, and that was how we explained why things move, because they have a desire to be somewhere else. It seems actually very human. So, like I said, there was a different way of thinking about nature. Things were cut up differently. And so I'm going to explain basically how Aristotle looked at the world, which was the basis of how a natural philosopher would have looked at the world before the 17th century. So everything was understood, any object, whether it's the books on this table or you and me or the earth itself, as a combination of prime matter, some sort of basic substance, right, and a substantial form. Okay, so you had kind of this nondescript goo and then some sort of shape that makes it into something. Okay, these are, of course, and you never find them separate. They'd always be together. This was the way it was understood. So substantial form could be a man or a horse or a tree. So the most basic things were actually quite complex. And then if we wanted to describe anything in the world, all we needed were 10 different points. And you could describe anything in the world. These were Aristotle's 10 categories. And you can find these anywhere. If you save yourself the trouble of writing them down, you type in Aristotle 10 categories in Google and you'll get loads of descriptions of it. So again, this substance that's listed here, quantity, how much, quality, what sort, relation, place, time, position, state, which way it's pointing, action, and passion. I'm not going to go into those in great detail, but just so you know, that these are the sorts of ways that things are described. Now, why is this important? I mean, was this only just a few guys who were thinking this way? That is, who cares? Well, your doctor, your ordinary GP, in the Middle Ages would have thought of things in these terms. This was the basis of medical thinking. Your lawyer. He also went to university. These were the two main, two of the three main professions. Medicine, law, and, of course, your priest. These were the basic terms in which everyone thought. This wasn't considered pagan thinking. This was just good, ordinary, credible ways of thinking about things in an intellectual way. Any respectable person in society would have thought this way. And I just need to emphasize that point. I'm not going to talk about astrology, but astrology was a regular part of medical practice before the 17th century and even through the 17th century. That's how you did medicine. You figured out what planets were in what position at the time of the illness and so on. That was considered legitimate, respectable thinking about things. Aristotle was the basis of thought in the universities. So if you came into a fresher's course in the university, the first things you learned were some of these basic ideas that I was showing to you. I should have brought a basic textbook from the university at the time. Even into the 17th century, that's what you would learn. So, what happened in the 17th century? Everything radically changed. I'm happy with the term scientific revolution, with certain qualifications. Historians have challenged that notion, wanting to show continuity between the Middle Ages and the 17th century. I think there's a lot to that. A lot of people critical of Marxist readings of history have problems with the idea of a scientific revolution. I think there's something to that too. But at base, something did fundamentally change. We don't talk in those terms anymore. And so we need to at least figure out what were the steps that happened that brought us to the current way of thinking. I mentioned last time René Descartes, one of my favorite philosophers, and I'll explain to you why. Now, this change from Aristotle to our current way of thinking, known as the scientific revolution, was brought in by what was called the new philosophy. That's fairly easy to understand. The new philosophy, and I described some of the chief points of that last time, and one of them is mechanization. And we owe our mechanical view of the world in a large part to René Descartes, French philosopher in the early 17th century. You had some reading from Descartes from his Treatise on Man. Treatise on Man was attached to another book called The World, Le Monde, which he never actually published when it was written. And there's a very good, clear reason for that. At the time, just about the time when he had finished the manuscript, he heard about Galileo's trial. I suppose people are roughly familiar with Galileo's trial. Okay, it's not a course on science and religion, so we won't go deep into that. But it was on the occasion of that trial that he decided not to publish this text. But I gave this as a reading anyway, because it gives you an idea of the sort of thinking going on at that time. Now, Descartes was self-conscious about what he was doing in the book The World and Treatise on Man. I just want to read a little bit from The World. I've marked, here it is. So here he is interacting with the Aristotelian view. They admit themselves that the nature of their motion is very little understood. To render it in some intelligible way, they have not yet been able to explain it more clearly than in these terms. Motus est actus, entis in potentia, prout in potentia est. For me, these words are so obscure that I am compelled to leave them in Latin because I cannot interpret them. And he writes in Latin, so it's not as if... And in fact, the sentence, motion is the actuality of a potential being insofar as it is impotential, is no clearer for being translated. By contrast, the nature of motion I mean to speak of here is so easy to know that the geometers themselves, who among all men are the most concerned to conceive very distinctly the things they study, have judged it simpler and more intelligible than the nature of their surfaces and lines, as is shown by the fact that they have explained line as the motion of a point and surface as the motion of a line. And he goes on. Let's see if I should continue. Yeah, and he goes on speaking in this way. So Descartes is saying that this is not a helpful way of looking at the world. Rather, he'd like to look at the world in another way. This is from the end of Treatise on Man, which I gave you to read, just the last bit. I should like you to consider that these functions, that's the functions within the body, essentially the human body, these functions follow from the mere arrangement of the machine's organs every bit as naturally as the movements of a clock or other automaton follow from the arrangement of its counterweights and wheels. In order to explain these functions, then, it is not necessary to conceive of this machine as having any vegetative or sensitive soul or other principle of movement in life, apart from its blood and its spirits, which are agitated by the heat of the fire burning continuously in its heart, a fire which has the same nature as all the fires that occur in inanimate bodies. So this is a radical transition from the former state, the Aristotelian view, to a mechanical one. And he was very self-conscious of what he was doing. He understood that this was a system that had no future in natural philosophy. You can see here, making fun of the Aristotelian definition of motion that I showed you earlier. And also when he speaks here of the vegetative or sensitive soul, it's this that the ball that's moving has this desire to be somewhere. That's the soul he's talking about. He's saying this is silly. There's no soul inside of a billiard ball telling it to go from one place to another. He's saying all we need are sort of how clocks work with weights pulling here and there. And in the Treatise on Man, you would have seen these pictures where hopefully you followed this. You can see here he's got an idea of a tube running from the toe all the way up to the brain. And he gives a very delightful little description of how nerves work as these little fibers that are being stimulated in a certain way and opening pores. He speaks of animal spirits. Don't take that in a kind of spiritual sense, in any religious sense. He means that some kind of fine fluid is the idea. Animal just being animated is the idea. He is trying to work out the basic idea of a nervous system. And now we know that there's, of course, different receptors for temperature and pain and pressure and so on. He was trying to describe it all in one sort of nerve working in a variety of different ways. But you have to admire the ingenuity and creativity of his view. And also in this other image from the reading, you see he's trying to work out a mechanical view of vision. I won't go into the Aristotelian view of vision. It'll take too much time. But here you can see, again, these tubes with pores that are opening and closing, kind of valves. And there was a physiological basis. I mean, there was the whole lymphatic system and circulatory system. So there was already some physiological understanding of tubes and valves and things like that. And then also the analogy to mechanical automata. He mentions going into gardens and seeing these cool fountains that had water that could squirt on you if you stepped on a certain place. And has all these examples of things that are in human experience, and there's no reason why to think that it isn't the same thing going on. So there is a physiological basis to what he's doing. He does do dissection. You can see here a cerebellum, and here's the optic nerve, the optic chiasm right there, and something like the LGN right here connecting into the pineal gland. So that's mechanical view. And as well, this applies on a cosmic scale. I showed you this picture last time. So we have a body traveling here through space, be it a planet or a comet or whatever. And what's governing that body's motion is the constant swirling action of vortices of this very fine substance which permeates everything. Descartes happened to not believe that there could be such a thing as a vacuum, but actually all of space was filled with this very fine, subtle, he says, substance, and that motions of things were due to them being caught up in the substance. Granted, okay, he had that bit wrong, but the idea is he's trying to work out how we can explain everything in a mechanical way. So if something's caught up in a tide pool, you see a circular motion. Not a tide pool. When you flush the loo. You know, that idea is when something's spinning around and around is how you get motion of even heavenly bodies. So this utterly, totally mechanical view of the world, it's very much to be attributed to Descartes. There are other factors going on in the 17th century besides philosophical thinking, though, that are almost equally as important. And they're a lot harder to see, but we can see them nonetheless. Oh, wait, I have... I got this out of order. There we are. Things going on in outside of the universities. Things like navigation and trade. And to a large part, these were dependent on a mechanical view of the world. And the instruments that they used, navigational devices, optical devices, began to be... It was Galileo's first telescope. It wasn't designed for looking at the sky. It was designed for earthly applications. And all of these features also played into the changing understanding of the world. As I mentioned last time, through navigation, the world in a way was becoming a different place. The known world was expanding. New species of plants were being discovered. Where did this fit into what had been known before? So that's mechanization. Another important factor is mathematization. Here we have, again, an image from Descartes. And this is, if you can't tell, it's a rainbow. And he's explaining the phenomenon of a rainbow in a physical way. So here's a man. And the rainbow seen in the sky. And this circle here is now an enlarged view of a raindrop. Not the... caricature of the raindrop that always appears in a teardrop in children's book, but what actually raindrops are, which is circles, spheres. A raindrop, and he's explaining how the ray of light is coming in, being refracted at various points, and coming out and generating a display of colors. So just as he was using the geometrical models and understanding motion here, mathematics is actually used to describe natural phenomena. You might remember that in math class, when you have this grid of x and y coordinates, we call that system the Cartesian coordinate system. Attribute that to René Descartes. And so now more and more phenomena could be explained in a mathematical way. I'll go back to this slide here. Johannes Kepler was a very important astronomer for his mathematical ability. He was not as much an observational astronomer, but he took the observations of Tycho Brahe and was able to use them in calculation to work out, in particular, I have shown here Kepler's second law. And the second law basically states that as a planet, he understood that planets move in ellipses. This is a grossly exaggerated ellipse. It was first thought they were circles because it's quite close to a circle, but it's just a... show the principle. As a planet moves around the sun, it sweeps out equal areas, so here and here, in equal times. So that's the second law of motion. Go back to the other. And we have here again, in this image, which is the frontispiece. Okay, frontispiece is the picture that's just inside, next to the cover in a book in the 16th and 17th century. It's kind of like your cover art. It's it shows the title and also advertises the features of the book. And for historians, it's very valuable because it shows some sense of the larger message that the author is trying to communicate. So you have here in this frontispiece for the Rudolphin tables, which is a table of astronomical figures used in calculations, in this frontispiece, a plethora of features of astronomy at the time. Of course, you have Brahe and Copernicus mentioned there, and Brahe's the island of Uraniborg, his observatory, and a number of astronomical instruments that you can see here, globes, spheres, quadrants, for here, for instance, measuring the angle of a heavenly body. Some of these instruments weren't new. I mean, they'd been around since the Middle Ages. There's Arab versions of all of these. But they're being used in a more systematic way to describe in a mathematical way the motions of planets. And Newton, which for anyone in Cambridge should not be an unfamiliar name. This is a previously unknown painting of Newton, by the way, that was recently on sale for £85,000. I don't know if it's sold yet, but if anyone's interested, let me know and I'll put you in contact. by a very famous painter, Sir Godfrey Kneller, who did a lot of portraits of scientific persons at the time. Isaac Newton, who was Lucasian Professor of Mathematics here in Cambridge, he was not the first Lucasian professor, contrary to the title of a book that came out not too long ago entitled Newton to Hawking. But of course, as I was told by the author, well, you just couldn't sell a book called From Barrow to Hawking. So Isaac Barrow was the first Lucasian professor, gave that up to be a minister of the gospel full time, and Isaac Newton took his place. And Isaac Newton is famous for a definitive mathematical explication of not only the planets, but these sort of ordinary billiard ball interactions in the terrestrial sphere. And here's a, I don't know, I guess, famous or well-known image from the book, which he published in 1687. And you see here, trying to understand planetary motion in a mathematical fashion and breaking it down geometrically in subsequently smaller and smaller pieces. And you can break down regular shapes into a curve. It's a version of what was known as the Archimedean method. What's interesting about this picture, though, is it shows Newton's relation to Descartes' thinking. Because if you imagine then that big swirling vortex around here, and as a body goes through it, it constantly gets knocked by the particles in the vortex. So you can see some relation between their ideas. So, but the title is very important. Here it is in Latin, and then in English, Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. Again, the idea is mathematizing nature, that nature can be described not in terms of souls desiring to be here or there, that Descartes was criticizing, and I explained at the beginning, but actually being governed by mathematical laws that we can write down. So we have mechanization, mathematization, and a third one is experiment, or as I said, experience. If you remember the picture I had on the title page in the beginning was a dissection of a dog, if you didn't catch that. There are several things going on. William Harvey, Englishman, published in 1628, De Motu Cordis, on the motion of the heart. And here we have an image of experiments going on. You could do this at home. yeah. Well, no, not that one. No, sorry. Well, you could, I guess. When's the ethics course, Dominic? No, the one up here with the arm. Okay, so how does, you know, what is this going on in the body? Well, let's try a few things. Let's try and look and see. So here we are testing the valves in the veins. is a mild tourniquet on the arm there, holding onto a pole, and you can sort of rub your hand down your arm and see the blood flowing through your veins and arteries. So William Harvey, motion of the heart. So he's the one who first discovered, I guess you could say, circulation of the blood. There were many animals which willingly or unwillingly gave themselves to science in coming to understand these things. Here is a diagram from a book in similar period explaining how to tie down animals for vivisection. So they did not only did dissection, but vivisection, that is, cutting things open while they're alive. This wasn't a party trick. This was serious business, and it was part of medical education. With dogs, they could, cut it open and see the parts moving. It was very interesting in vivisecting a dog after it had just eaten, because you could see the lymphatic system light up suddenly, and there was some discussion about what that was and what was going on. Of course, you can see the heart pumping, and that you can see that if you poke a vein, blood shoots out of it. It seems obvious, and that it's not necessary for us to even do such things. But if you come from a perspective that doesn't understand that blood circulates in the way it does, it is a novel phenomenon that needs explanation. So, yeah, here I think is a cat being put in a jar. I don't know if it's sealed, but anyway. Experiment. This was experiments done by another Englishman, Robert Boyle, and his air pump. This is a picture of his air pump. And you have a sphere up here with a stopcock, so a valve to close it off. And you have a piston mechanism down here. So you open the stopcock, crank, the piston draws air down, close the stopcock, bring the crank back up, open the stopcock, turn the crank. And you do this a number of times. And as long as the seal doesn't break, which is a problem with the device, you get a low pressure area inside the glass globe. And then you could do all sorts of experiments inside there. You could drop things and see that a feather and a lead shot will fall at the same rate. You could put an animal in there and see what happens, which they did. it dies. you could put a bladder. They didn't have rubber balloons, but they could take a sheep's bladder and tie it off tightly. And as you draw the air out, it starts to grow. All sorts of interesting things that you could do to test one of the chief debates of the time was whether there was such a thing as a vacuum. Remember I said that Descartes didn't believe there was. Aristotle said that nature abhors a vacuum. Again, it's the idea of natural things having these desires. It doesn't like to have vacuums. We can do experiments now. We can create artificial situations which will test our ideas. And Robert Boyle's air pump was designed to do that. This is a later painting of supposedly Boyle with people around him, and there is a, you can't see it very well here, but there is an animal in the globe there. I should also note that this sort of apparatus is extremely expensive to build, and Boyle was able to do it with family resources. He was also, by the way, never married, and I don't know if the animals and the being expired in there had anything to do with that. But so, experiment, and finally, the idea of decentering of ourselves. So while at the same time there is a subjective element in the experience of experiment, there is at the same time, in this process of mechanization and mathematization, a decentering of ourselves. The world is sort of being evacuated of its souls. And here's, again, I'll just go quickly through this. There's loads you could read. Nicholas Copernicus is on the revolutions of the heavenly orbs. This is a picture from that. It's fairly drab and uninteresting, except for the fact that the sun is at the center of the solar system. That's the significant point here. I could have given you pictures of others where formerly under the Aristotelian and Ptolemaic conception, Ptolemy was the sort of textbook astronomy book before this period, where the Earth was at the center. But here we have the Sun at the center, Mercury, Venus, Earth, the Moon revolving around the Earth, and the other planets all in their correct order, as the order that we would now understand them. So, yes? That's right. Yes. Not that I know of. There was this, when he published this book, there was an introduction added to it that he didn't write. And this introduction said, this is a useful way of doing the math. It doesn't say anything about the nature of things. Of course, Copernicus believed that this is the nature of things. But so that's an interesting story in itself. You could quickly find that if you look. Right, decentering ourselves. So we're not at the center of the universe. It wasn't just the solar system, it was the whole universe, because outside of that was then the sphere of the stars revolving around. Galileo, so that was 1546, 43. Here, Galileo, thinking under the Copernican model, publishes his dialogue concerning two chief world systems. And the dialogue, it was very common to write things as a dialogue or a discussion between people rather than writing out sort of a systematic mathematical treatise. He starts out in the beginning, after the preface. So the dialogue takes place over several days. And there are three characters, Salviati, Sagredo, and Simplicio. And so Salviati starts out in this way. Yesterday we resolved to meet today and discuss as clearly and in as much detail as possible the character and the efficacy of those laws of nature which up to the present have been put forth by the partisans of the Aristotelian and Ptolemaic position on the one hand and by the followers of the Copernican system on the other. So that's the dialogue of two chief world systems, the Copernican on the one hand and the Aristotelian and Ptolemaic on the other. Is the sun at the center or is the earth at the center? Since Copernicus places the earth among the movable heavenly bodies, making it a globe like a planet, we may well begin our discussion by examining the peripatetic steps in arguing the impossibility of that hypothesis, what they are, and how great is their force and effect. For this it is necessary to introduce into nature two substances which differ essentially. These are the celestial and the elemental, the former being invariant and eternal, the latter temporary and destructible. This argument Aristotle treats in his book De Chilo on the heavens, introducing it with some discourses dependent upon certain general assumptions, and afterwards confirming it by experiments and specific demonstrations. Following the same method, I shall first propound and then freely speak my opinion, submitting myself to your criticisms, particularly those of Simplicio, that stout champion and defender of Aristotelian doctrines. So you've got these three characters. There's Salviati, who is sort of Galileo, speaking in his voice for the Copernican view. And then there's Simplicio, so the simpleton, arguing Ptolemaic system, and Salviati, you know, like the savior. And then there's Sagredo, the wise man, who just sort of keeps things going in between. So Galileo's not pulling any punches here. He's speaking explicitly, and as I noted earlier, he was getting in trouble for that with the church. This is, so that's the frontispiece, and there are the three characters, Copernicus, Aristotle and Ptolemy, and in this picture, actually, it seems that Galileo is the face in all three of them. Now, this picture is from a book that wasn't a philosophical dialogue, but actually a publication based on observational astronomy. Galileo's famously looking through the telescope, his starry messenger. And you can see here, it's not an actual picture of the moon, but a stylized picture of what one sees when one looks at the moon as a half moon, so when half of it's dark. And the important thing here is he's showing that it's bumpy. I can remember as a boy seeing the moon through a telescope for the first time and being completely amazed that it was bumpy. If you haven't done it, you must do it. It goes against everything you thought that you knew about this perfect silver disk. I mean, the philosophers had thought of the planets as perfect bodies. And this shows that the moon is like the Earth, that the moon is just an ordinary, bumpy, rough object with pits and marks in it, like everything that we're accustomed to here, that it's not this perfect celestial substance. Something common to experience. He argues it also in the dialogue. He argues about this in a philosophical way. Here he gives it observationally, again showing he's arguing in the new way, but he's also capable of arguing it in the old way too. So that was the idea of decentering ourselves, though, that no longer the system of the universe is not in this divided realm the way that it formerly was, but it's all being sort of collapsed and homogenized in a way. Where are we? Oh, wow. Okay. Okay. So, does that leave room for God then? Because it seems like God is quickly being, again, evacuated from the system. It might seem like now that God was no longer a necessary part of the world anymore. Things didn't have souls. Seems like we didn't need our own soul, because, although I should note, Descartes was a very religious man. This came up in one of the questions. He did, his system was couched in Christian terms and not just on the face of it. I believe he was a faithful believer. That's beside the point, though. It seems, though, that this new system doesn't need God in the way that it might have before, that we can explain things in natural terms, in mathematical terms, in mechanical terms. And we don't need God to do anything anymore. So there's several points. And now I'm sort of jumping ahead now and talking about the idea of this mechanical revolution in general. That was the sort of historical origin of it. Now, what do we do with that now? And so is there room for God in this mechanical world? When we talk about God creating the world, which is one of the chief points where a Christian can talk about the mechanical view of the world, we need to make a distinction about the how and the that. Okay? The scriptures clearly teach that God created the world. The scriptures do not teach how God created the world. And just because the scriptures don't teach how God created the world doesn't mean that they no longer assert that God created the world. I think that's important to say right up front. Further, the Bible itself is not against the physical view of the world. It endorses the physico-mechanical view of the world. Since Genesis always gets dragged into these discussions, you can look right there. In chapter 2, verse 5, when no bush of the field was yet in the land, and no small plant of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord had not caused it to rain on the land. The Bible doesn't have any problem with understanding the world in physical or biological terms. The Bible understands that it has to rain for something to grow. It's not as if understanding things in their details in a mechanical, physical, biological way somehow makes the Bible irrelevant anymore. I think that's also takes some of the threat factor out of a mechanical understanding of the world. Also, we can remember that God is the one who runs the world. I'm running out of time, but I do want to spend time on this. You might want to open to Psalm 19 at this point. I'm going to go through this. I'm going to go through the whole psalm because everything is encapsulated right here. Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims His handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their measuring line goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them He has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them is your servant warned. In keeping them, there is great reward. Who can discern his errors? Declare me innocent from hidden faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Now, there's a lot here in this psalm, but there's one important feature that I want to bring attention to, and that's this apparent transition between verses 6 and 7. So the first six verses seem to be talking about the wonder of nature, how it's beautiful, and how God is to be glorified and magnified in having made it. And then at verse 7, it's suddenly talking about moral issues. It seems like it's these two parts that don't fit together. Is this the sort of, does the psalm start out with doxology, the sort of warm up the person for his prayer when he gets down to personal serious issues? Is that what's going on? That might be part of it, but I don't think that's the whole story. What's important in understanding here in this transition is that the conception of God as ruler and lawgiver is the same in the moral sphere or the physical sphere. God's law reigns in our hearts, and God's law reigns in the natural world as well. The world may be a mechanical place, but it's a mechanism that's run by God. It applies in all spheres. So, I'm not going to go through bit by bit here, but the idea is that the world wouldn't go if God didn't make it go. We can come back to that in question time if you want in more detail. One final matter here is actually, before I come to that, I do want to just say a couple more things about the running of the world. And it's I draw in what I said in the introduction last time about autonomy and God being the ultimate artificer. And we need to watch out. Yes, we can be concerned about mechanism because it makes it look like the world is autonomous. But we have every reason to be firm about the view that God is the only autonomous being and that the world does not run without Him saying so. Again, this is the point, I think, of Psalm 19. We see, for example, Jesus spoke to the storm and it stopped. Now, who of us, by saying, for instance, F equals MA or E equals MC squared, can make anything happen? And what of those descriptions? What do they actually mean? Is there power in the mathematical formula? No, nothing happens because of the mathematical formula. The thing still has to happen in the world, and it's God who's making it go. In a sense, We have returned to the Aristotelian conception in some sense, not that we put souls back in things, but that we recognize that we need to understand metaphysically, ontologically, that is, in their being, something must drive them, something must make them go. And the mathematical representations don't make them go. They describe them, but they don't make them go. And so now that brings me to the point of saving the phenomena. This is, actually comes from Plato. Saving the phenomena, or saving the experiences. The point of science, at least in one view, is to give an account of what's happening. And if we give a mathematical law which describes planetary motion, we've given an account, we've given a simple, tidy representation of what we observe. And that's the point of science, is to do that. It doesn't necessarily speak about how the system got there or what its metaphysical principle of motion is, but only to describe the phenomena, predict the phenomena. One philosopher, as an epigram in the front of his book, has this, he puts Sos Deinti Phenomena, the save the phenomena from Plato, and then under that he has, save the surface and you save all, Sherwin-Williams, which is a paint company in the United States. That is the idea, that what we're doing in science is very much on the surface. But what we can emphasize to people is that, yes, you may have explained it on the surface, but God is the one who's making it go. So just a quick summary then. We have in the 17th century, divinity, and I put this in quotes, divinity was removed from the physical world. The sort of innate principles of things that were necessary to understand their motion, these desires to be over there, were removed. In its place was a mechanical account of natural phenomena, clocks, fluids in pipes, those sorts of things. However, we have to remember that the divinity that was removed was not God. He's still there as creator and upholder of all things by his divine power. So the mechanical view does not threaten Christianity one bit, but rather testifies to the awe-inspiring God who fashioned it in the first place. And you ask any scientist and they'll say, you wouldn't believe what I just saw yesterday. Or, you know, open any science textbook. I mean, you cannot help be amazed at the wonders of look at a hemoglobin molecule. Anyway. But there is a warning here, a very solemn warning, and I give it to you from Galileo. Take note, theologians, that in your desire to make matters of faith out of propositions relating to the fixity of sun and earth, you run the risk of eventually having to condemn as heretics those who would declare the earth to stand still and the sun to change position. Eventually, I say, at such a time as it might be physically or logically proved that the earth moves and the sun stands still. And it is a good warning that Galileo gives us. We have to be careful as Christians not to take sides on certain issues in science and attach them to our theology, lest you set your theology up for being disproved. And I think we have we've not listened to Galileo, but that will be for a few months from now. So that's all for our first hour. Just a reminder. Any questions?
You said something about how deism came into
interior. Okay. Yeah.
First, explain what deism is.
Deism is the idea that God gets the ball rolling and then it runs on its own. God is a kind of first cause. I'm actually going to talk about cause a lot in the next hour, so maybe just come back to it and see if I catch it there, and if not, then ask again. Yeah?
All of these people that you mentioned are sort of... least chronologically, they're kind of children or grandchildren of the Reformation.
Yes.
And yet most of them, with the exception perhaps of Isaac Newton, would, I guess, be within the Roman Catholic Church of that day.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
my question is, can you see some influence there from the Protestant Reformation, or would you like to explain how these people were able to sort of challenge the assumptions of their day in some other way?
Okay. Several questions there. The first one is, who belonged to what denomination? And that's pretty... I mean, I picked some of these characters because I study religious scientists, so they're the ones I know the best. But they also happen to be central figures. Descartes was a Roman Catholic. He went to a Jesuit school initially kept his Roman Catholic faith throughout his life. You could even say that in part his unwillingness to publish The World and Treatise on Man was in deference to the Church. Not just fear, but respect. Kepler was a Lutheran. Boyle was an Anglican. Harvey, I'm not sure, though many of them in the Harveian school, which they didn't have a school, but people who followed did anatomy the way he did were Anglicans. And it's true that there are a large number of people, whether they were in the Royal Society or other places, who were Reformed thinkers in Protestant churches. There were, though, I'd say there were as many Roman Catholic natural philosophers, at least in the 16th century, as there were Protestant ones. So it's true, though, that there does seem to be a connection between the Reformation and the flowering of the scientific revolution. And some historians, Merton, Ryer Hoycaus, have made a point out of this. Peter Harrison also, who's at Oxford now, is also thinks this is an important feature. He has a new book, which I just bought. It just came out, called The Fall of Man and the Foundations of Science, which I can't wait to read. It's tricky, though, because I'm not avoiding this question. I'm just trying to figure out how to answer it. It's hard to answer in a short way. Some people, Harrison, for instance, would point to features of how the Bible began to be interpreted and how nature was looked at, that there's an analogy there. You can see that in his book, Bible and Protestantism, or something like that is the title. And I think there's something to this, although it might also be considered a general feature of Renaissance humanism, too, and not particular to the Reformation. That's why I'm saying it's so hard to answer these questions. There's a lot going on in this period. Just because, say, a reformed-minded person is also interested in natural philosophy doesn't necessarily mean it's because of their theological convictions that they do things the way they do. There is a general idea of moving away from tradition, which is a feature of Protestantism, but it's also a feature of humanism as well. So it's a really difficult question, but it's a good question. It's lots of people are thinking about it and writing about it. I could give you some references if you want. I don't know if that... I can't really answer your question very well because it's such a good, hard question.
I suppose what I'm going to get at is... And again, you don't want to be simplistic or even, from a Christian point of view, triumphalistic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Birth too. I don't want to be... reductionistic like that. But,
yeah.
But I'm trying to understand why this revolution of thought took place and what some of the ideas were in the background that sort of maybe gave birth to it. And that seems to be the obvious one on the stage of world history.
Yeah.
You know, that is going to have that kind of influence.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to know. it's a staple of the history of science. We have a lot of interest in modern science. We want to know where it came from. That's why we're doing this today. Joseph Needham, another Cambridge name, is the Needham Institute over in, where's our orientation? Someone can point to it for me. It's this end of town. Had the basic question, why did it happen in the West and not in China? China seemed to have all the sort of institutional structures which would have made a scientific revolution possible, but it didn't happen. That was a question he had posed. And there's a lot to be said. I mean, Merton, for instance, thinks that it was the Puritan... Well, the Weber-Tawney hypothesis that the Puritan work ethic had something to do with it as well. It's an open question. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you something about the God of the Gaps.
Ah, right.
I guess you might get on to that.
Okay.
It's in context with apologetics.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm thinking is that, you know, I work in a scientific place and scientific background, and it seems that before I was a Christian, a lot of the arguments about whether God was real or not, Christianity was founded on, well, science disproved all of this and all of that. And the more that science discovers about the natural way things happen, the less room there is for God to exist, because we know how it happens. It all happens naturally. And I wondered if, you know, where the birth of this idea of God of the Gaps came from and how we address it. I mean, I like what you said about the hemoglobin molecule.
Yeah.
There we are. We know the structure of this molecule in great detail. We know what it does. We know how it's formed. We know a lot about that. And so there are plenty of Christian scientists around who look at what is known and think it's even more wonderful because of that.
Yeah.
And therefore must have been created rather than just formed by chance.
Yeah.
And it's that contrast between the two approaches there.
Yeah.
Where this comes from.
So, if we represent... You're going to give me a hard time about these diagrams like last night. Everything that could be known as this line, okay? All right? Huh? Well, we have to reduce, when you're dealing with this scale, you sort of have to reduce things down, okay? Everything that can be known as this line. And what science is able to explain on its own terms, represented by this is everything that science knows, okay? And there's gaps, so these are the gaps you're talking about. So, you know, let's say in physics we have a fairly solid line here. In biology there's some breaks, in chemistry some breaks, and of course psychology we barely know anything. almost not qualifying as science. Okay, so these are the gaps he's talking about. So what happens is that one thing is that people will want to fill those in with God, okay? And that's the God of the gaps argument. Of course, you know, Galileo warned us about this, right? He said, well, you better be careful about doing that. Well, this is a variation of Galileo's warning. Be careful about doing that because if they fill that in, it also deletes God at the same time. So you have to be careful about the God of the gaps argument. The way to answer this, you know, where did the God of the gaps argument come from? I mean, there was certainly a sense, at least in Galileo's time. I think... There's a more benign sense of the God of the gaps argument, which simply recognizes that there are mysteries in the world that we can't explain, but that are known to God. That's a sort of benign that's not sort of the God of the gaps, but the God over the whole universe understanding. But you can see how a God of the gaps argument would come from it. Historically, I'm a little less certain about this sort of formulation of it. As far as responding, though, I think what's important to remember is that when we deal with this all that can be known here, represented in this line, or even what we do know, it's not that God is filling in the gaps. It's that, as I was saying before, God is there at every point, upholding the whole thing. I mean, He is the great pillars, we can use this ancient biblical language, on which the whole world is upheld. And so, God of the gaps argument is actually allowing autonomy where it shouldn't be allowed in the first place. It's not that this part works on its own and then we put God in here. It's we need to recognize that the whole system is upheld by God in the first place. I think that's the best way to reorient. Does that capture what you're thinking about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just a plenty of profound Christian scientists around who are more amazed when they discover how something works, than before when they didn't understand. So in other words, the understanding it brings a greater appreciation of God rather than the not understanding.
I think so. I think Anyone? Yeah.
I've kind of taken it for granted that until Darwin and evolutionary theory, that from the Greeks to Victorian times, people assumed that there was always a first cause and an original origin. But recently I've read about Greek philosophers having a view of a constant cycle, an eternal return. Could you explain about that? Because obviously that's back in vogue in terms of an explanation of the universe.
Yes, that's right. Well, the general Greek view was that things do operate in a cyclical fashion, that the circle itself geometrically was perfect. In fact, things had to orbit in circles because it was the perfect form that, of course, the celestial body, which is perfect, would move in. Goes without saying. But also, there were other philosophers besides the Socrates, Plato, Aristotle that we normally talk about. Before Socrates, there was the philosopher Heraclitus. And the fundamental principle in his philosophy is flux, flow. You never step into the same river twice, that everything's flowing and in motion. It's and not in the teleological sense, towards an end point. So, yes, there was definitely in Greek ideas this notion. And I guess there's something of that picked up in 19th century German Romanticism as well. I couldn't spell it out for you in detail. I don't know. What context have you been seeing it popping up lately? And what?
I just read something by Frank Tipler, that physicist, had a theory about the Omega point. His point was that we kind of take it for granted that there should be an origin, but it isn't necessarily intuitively obvious. Various philosophers down the ages have assumed instead that there is a constant
cycle. I mean, there is. I don't think I'm going to do anything. Yeah, I don't plan on doing anything on cosmology, but there's these various views of the universe. So, one of them is that. Okay, so we have time on this axis, and in a very rough and ready way, space on this axis. And we have this, Big Bang explosion, and the universe expands from this point. What happens next is a matter open to discussion. Is it going to sort of level off, or is it going to go in this sort of continuous expansion, or are we going to have this model of it's going to reach a point where gravity's then going to take over and it's going to contract again and then maybe go off again? Yeah, I mean, there's that cyclical view there, too. It's you can't do experiments on this scale. So, I mean, you need the whole universe to do the experiment. That's not to say that you can't say anything. I mean, it's funny, but there's other things we can do in particle accelerators to simulate conditions very near to this time.
I've said more from the point of view in apologetics.
Yeah.
I maybe falsely just assume that people would take it as axiomatic that there's always an origin.
Yeah.
And sort of, we have that intuition commonly amongst mankind. But
yeah.
Someone who's well-read in history would say, no, that's not necessarily true.
Mm.
There have been many civilizations that have assumed that there is a cycle and an eternity in that cycle.
Okay.
So I can't let it rely on that as an apologetic to appeal to people.
But you're saying that everyone's intuition is that there is a starting point.
Yeah.
I think. No. I think your sense of people's intuitions is right, and it's not only that there is a start. And I think I know what you're asking me now. Sorry about the digressions. And it's. I think the intuition is not only that there's a starting point, but that there's an ending point too. That's the two ends of this linear way of thinking, and I think that's a very valuable insight from an apologetic standpoint, and it allows you to go in rather quickly on a simple gospel point. If you look in Genesis, and where is it? Oh, right, there it is in front of me. And out of the ground the Lord God made to spring up every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life was in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This tree of life in here, not too much is said about it in the early Genesis accounts, but it does appear again in Revelation. And this tree of life is a sign of things to come. And the reason that we have this innate sense of starting points and end points is that that is how we are fundamentally created, with a view towards an end, even for Adam. We can sometimes be misled in thinking that the garden was the end state, and only Adam spoiled it, and therefore we had to go through all this. It's not actually the case. The tree of life was there as a sign of things to come, some yet greater blessing to come. And so this teleological, this linear, this starting point and end point view is innately built into human nature from the beginning. It's not just a function of a redemptive history that came about because of an accident or something that God didn't foresee. But redemptive history is built into our nature. So I think this idea of a starting point and end point is there, and you ask the person to give an account for it. Why did they think that? Why do people think, for instance, that we're progressing? This notion of progress.
Can I come back to
yeah, sorry. Sure.
I'm just going to say very quickly that in the apologetic sense, that the things have started and people, it's a bit like, people saying, well, where did life come from? And one of the favorite arguments is, oh, well, it didn't start in any way, it came from outer space.
Uh-huh.
Or it doesn't set the origin one step back, well, where did that come from?
Yeah.
But, you can get people to a point where they will are happy, because people are more comfortable with beginnings and ends, infinity.
Yeah.
But then, of course, at the end of the day, we know that that's where we're headed anyway.
Uh-huh.
So, ultimately, we're a bit on the back foot there, because we're with eternity, we know there is no beginning and end.
Uh-huh.
And it's not time going on forever, it's the absence of time altogether. So ultimately, as Christians, we are in a way selling the idea of an eternity without a beginning and without an end.
You just said eternity would be without time whatsoever.
Yeah.
Okay, did I talk about this last time, eternity and eternal? And
no.
Okay. There are two basic ways of understanding eternity. One as time, which continues forever in eternity, which is to be without time or outside of time, which Augustine mentions in his Confessions. He talks about that a little bit. When we speak of the nature of God, we speak of him as in eternal, and this eternal in the second sense, that is outside of time. That time is a function of the created order. It's a condition under which we're bound to move. We can't move outside of time and show up in some other time. We can only move forward in it. And in the Christian view, our blessed state, which we'll have after death with God in the resurrection, is one that's still within the context of time. We are temporal creatures. Our whole body is organized and it moves in time. That won't change. Nor will God's nature change as being outside that time. But what is going to be different is that we will have achieved a state. There'll be a state of rest. So while it will go on in time, it won't progress. It will be perfect in that sense. So it's an eternal that stays the same. You get both. I think if it's cleverly titled. David, yeah?
I'd like to throw a cat amongst the pigeons, as usual.
Oh, wait, throw a what?
A cat amongst the pigeons.
Okay. A spanner in the works?
Yes.
Okay.
No, a cat amongst the pigeons is not very classy. I think we've got to be quite careful in our thinking here. First of all, theologically, I'd agree that God has put within us this idea of a beginning and end, certainly in this earth. But I think as we look at civilization across the world as a whole, Eastern cultures very clearly do have a cyclical view of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Western culture traces back to Judeo-Christian thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we, sitting in this room, have a sense of a beginning and end may be very little to do with the fact that God has put that in us, but we have this such a strong cultural identity.
That's which cut, really gets me.
Yeah.
Ah, and okay.
I think moreover, this, another, relating to this point, I think it's important that we are careful when we, in apologetics, say, well, there must have been a beginning. Where did the universe come from then? Because certainly Stephen Hawking's idea of origins and unbounded origins where time and space come into existence at the same time, it doesn't have any meaning scientifically to say where did this come from. It's like saying what's north of the North Pole. The Earth is spherical. Time and space come into existence at the same time. The only valid question is for us, or where the key question is, where do the laws of the universe come from? Because physicists are all working towards theories of everything, but they're not. It's impossible for them to explain the so-called laws of the universe. I think that's what we've got to challenge people towards, not the fact that it's necessarily beginning. Within our own culture, cosmology, from the beginning of the century to the middle of the last century, there's the idea of a steady-state universe. So the idea that it was a beginning was a very strange idea, even in our own culture.
I think it's worth pointing that out, because a lot of astronomers, cosmologists particularly, when the Big Bang was first posited, were not that happy about it philosophically.
No.
Because it gave the idea of a beginning, which brought them back to this state where they might have to think that God did it after all, if you like, which they found difficult from that point of view.
Einstein wasn't happy either, so he creates his cosmological constant to explain that constant a universe which has come in again through the back door. But that was the whole, even in Einstein's time, you know, this great thinker, it was that there was...
He took that back, universe. You know.
He took it back. He said it's his biggest mistake.
Yeah.
Although it wasn't his biggest mistake, because it now appears there is something about a cosmological constant in the context.
Oh, well, I was gonna. There's two things there. There's the first one about the cultural paradigm, which conditions how we think about things, and then the second one about what's the best way to address science. That's a good point that you raise, and I'm not going to be able to address it as well as I'd like to because of my ignorance of Eastern ideas. There are other features of Eastern ideas which can be useful, though. A sense of rebirth, a new beginning. And in China as well, I mean, there is this reverence for those who have passed on, in a sense that there is something greater. I mean, I'm just sort of speaking very generally, and maybe some other folks here could shed more light on it. But that's true. In various cultures, certain features appear more distinctly than others. And I guess the one about beginnings and ends might be a strongly Western one. That doesn't mean that there aren't other things, though, that come out. I mean, that's destiny.
If we were born without this culture, the natural way would be to think of cycles.
No, there's no natural way without a culture, you see. You can't, it just, there isn't.
It's possible to...
That's like saying there's prime matter without a form, you know.
Well, some island cultures are highly isolated from each other and have potentially have very divergent views. But my point is...
But they're not thus acultural, though.
No, the culture develops out of... a few individuals
who came from somewhere. I mean, they didn't evolve by themselves on that island.
It's like doing a thought experiment. Imagine yourself landing in the world.
Yeah.
You'd see the sun going round. You'd see the months if you were in the tropics. You'd see the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
You'd see animals eating things and then dying and being eaten by something else.
Yeah.
There might be. I think it's our culture which is more saying it. Especially when we think also that the if you look at where origin stories have come from, they come out of Mesopotamia. If you trace back the various stories, they all come from the Fertile Crescent area, which is where our story, the Judeo-Christian stories, come from as well.
Yes, yeah. With qualifications.
Yep.
There's some folks who haven't asked a question on either Saturday yet. So if there's anyone who hasn't asked a question yet, I just want to make sure that
others. One more question because it's great.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I thought we. Well.
We'll give my one.
Yeah. Well, I've got 2 minutes on my watch and 4 minutes.
Well,
I think you asked a question last time.
I
was just trying to say, I want to make sure, and on the website as well, please, if you, I might have put you off a little too much in saying be clear in your questions, but
I kind of had more of a comment. I think for someone asked about why Copernicus got in trouble. I think I read somewhere, I mean, Copernicus was actually a Catholic priest, I think I read somewhere, if I recall this correctly, that the book, he died on the day his book was published. Bruce is thinking, it's trying to be me.
Was that then the justification for taking Galileo to court then? Something like retribution.
Well, didn't he sort of not publish it because he didn't want to until his death? I seem to recall something along those lines. That he left it as long as he could before he published it. Because he knew it was going to cause a lot of trouble. Yeah, I think it was published after he died, but he basically set everything in motion just before he died.
No pun intended.
Sorry?
anyone else? I guess we will then.
Can I just ask about Ecclesiastes 11 verse 3?
Okay.
In the context of time and service.
Can I read it first? Sorry.
It's talked about God setting eternity in the hearts of man, basically. So I'm curious to hear your comments about that in relation to what you mentioned earlier about eternity and time.
What did you say, 11:4?
11:3.
11:3.
Three.
I'm not sure what's going on there. I mean, I could guess, but that's not usually a good thing to do with the scriptures. I'd want to reserve judgment until I thought about it more carefully. What were you thinking about it as a question?
I'm not sure, really. It was just the word eternity and the whole idea of us thinking about it and thinking about time. And that word just came to mind. How it figures in. I'm not entirely sure myself at the moment. I mean, the whole question of time and eternity is something that obviously we can't comprehend because of our limitations within time at the moment. And you say God is the only one who is eternal, and we will still be in time when beyond this physical universe.
Mm-hmm.
But how that works is not clear at all. How time works outside in the spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the word is used for eternity here, and so I'd want to carefully look at that. I mean, there's this bland sense, it's just, you know, he wants the blessed state, but without looking more carefully, I couldn't speak. T?
I tried to walk closer to people.